to Wellington Inkslings. Welcome back to another episode of the Inkslingers podcast. I'm your host, Dee Woods, and with me in the studio we have Caroline.
I'm Caroline Wandon.
Rowan.
And I'm Rowan Clemison.
And also back with us is Angela Wells.
Hi there.
So, this week we're going to be talking about a number of things. First of all, we're going to talk about Caroline and her latest publication. We'll also be talking about NaNoWriMo because it's, oh my god, 1 week away.
Dum-da-dum.
And a few other things about what we've been reading right now and whether or not we like the latest book-to-film adaptations. So, let's start with Caroline. Tell us about your latest work.
All right. You say latest, it's actually my first.
Oh.
So this is, my first novel is A Different Three Words. It just came out last week. I'm very excited about it. Yes, it's about, oh, see, there's two descriptions I could give you. There's the plot description, and then there's the more important character description. Which do you want?
Let's go for the character description first.
All right.
And if we can understand the book from that, we won't move on.
It's, A Different Three Words is about a young man who learns to accept others as they are, and a young woman who learns to accept herself as she is.
Intriguing. I was looking at the blurb just a little bit before before we started, and I noticed that there's mentioning of a character who's deaf. Is that the young woman who must accept herself?
No, that is the sister of the young woman who must accept herself. No, the deaf sister is actually quite at home in her own skin. She's very comfortable being herself, and that was important for me writing this book, because so often characters who are deaf or have another similar disability are sort of portrayed as being the one who's sort of unsure or needs help, and I very much wanted Rochelle to not be that character, because she is very confident and she's the one who knows what's going on. And because I have studied sign language at Victoria University, and I participate in the deaf community in Wellington, and the deaf people I am friends with are all very self-confident people, and they are all very much at home being who they are. And so it was important to me that Rochelle was like that.
Right.
That's good. That's good, because like a lot of times in media, you know, it's a symptom of lazy writing and also just ableism to be all like,
yes,
oh, this person has a disability, the poor lamb.
Yeah, and actually, after I wrote, because I wrote A Different Three Words last year for NaNoWriMo. This was my nanovel last year. Mm. And it was actually after I'd written the first draft that I came across a list, I think it was on Tumblr, someone was saying, if you're writing a deaf character, here are the things you should never, ever do.
Mm.
Don't make them unintelligent. Don't make them, you know, illiterate. Don't make them loners. Because a lot of deaf people, I mean, deaf people vary in the same way that hearing people do. And a lot of them are very social, especially within the deaf community. You know, don't make them master lip readers, because it's actually very hard to lip read. And the only thing on that list that I did was Rochelle signs. I mean, not all deaf people sign, but Rochelle does, because she is a part of the deaf community, and so, of course, sign language is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting to note that here in New Zealand, sign language is our third national language.
Yep. Yes, it's an official language.
After English and Te Reo.
Yep. And actually, funnily enough, English isn't an official language. It's a national language, but not official.
So. Oh, so when you say the official languages, then
we only have
not
two.
So it's technically, it's Te Reo not?
Te Reo is an official language.
Is it official language?
Yes. It's the difference between,
so it's like default
between de facto languages and de jure languages.
Right. Okay.
Something I've been studying in my linguistics class, but that's not important. So yes, New Zealand Sign Language is an official language, and it has, you know, we have New Zealand Sign Language Week, just the same as we have Māori Language Week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, I suppose I gravitated slightly towards the deaf, for just looking at the blurb, I gravitated slightly towards the the deaf sister, because the other sister seems actually quite, from the blurb at least, quite self-possessed.
Yes.
And you're actually suggesting perhaps that's not necessarily the case?
Yes. I'm just going to pick out a phrase that's actually on the back blurb, and I considered whether or not I should put this on the back cover. Charlotte, the girl, is a self-proclaimed manic pixie dream girl.
Oh dear.
Yes. And that is, I mean, it's a concept that is very interesting to me, because I first encountered manic pixie dream girl, the trope, in John Green's work. Mm-hmm. And so for me, my first experience of it was a subversion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of how it's always been for me. And I mean, since then I've researched it more and realized that no, that is a subversion. Mm-hmm. But this Charlotte is also a subversion, because she's the one who has to learn to accept herself how she is.
Mm-hmm.
And so her part of the story is about realizing that she doesn't need to try to be this manic pixie dream girl. Mm-hmm. In order to have friends and in order to have a good life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's her part of the story, is her realizing that that's not a trope that she needs to be in life.
Mm. Right. Are you guys familiar with that concept? I mean, you've probably heard the phrase.
I'm a little bit familiar.
Zoe Deschanel.
Pretty much the girl in
every Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie.
I was thinking of her in Yes Men, but I think she's more or less that there. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Not Yes Men.
The new girl.
I
think it is Yes Man.
Yes Man.
It's where Jim Carrey entered that seminar where it was like, yes. Instead of saying no, try saying yes, and yes, all that happened.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, basically.
And Zoe Deschanel is the rather young love interest.
Yeah.
Yes, the concept of the manic pixie dream girl, if you break it down, and this is the way that Charlotte explains it to Lucas, is she is the girl who latches on to sad, lonely male leads. Mm-hmm. And fixes them so they can fix the world.
Yeah.
So she is very conscious that her purpose is to make men happy so they can do great things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's Charlotte's place at the start of the novel, is trying to be this trope and seeing nothing wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that's that's not good.
No, it's not. That's the story, basically.
Not good for her, and as a guy, possibly not good for the guy either.
It's just another form of codependence, just written with an alternative sheen on it.
Yes. Yeah. And because Lucas isn't familiar with this trope before he meets Charlotte, and he only has her explanation of it, he doesn't realise that there's anything wrong with it too, until he realises what Charlotte is actually doing by trying to play this trope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, I've had relationships which were similar to that, and actually it was no good. It was no good for me. So being perfected by someone is never a good thing.
No. But you're supposed to say, yeah, it's not good for anyone.
Yeah.
No. It's actually at some points very damaging, in a different three words, to Charlotte and Lucas's friendship.
Mm-hmm.
When Lucas realizes that Charlotte is only doing these things because she wants to play this type, and she wants to make him happy, and he's sort of wondering if she really does like him or if she's just latching onto him because she can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it about self-validation, or is it because she likes
using someone to validate yourself? Yeah. Yeah.
So back to the sort of my character description, Lucas needs to learn to accept Rochelle for who she is.
Mm-hmm.
Because he initially, when he first meets her, is very uncomfortable with her being deaf and him not being able to communicate with her.
Because there's stigma, like hell in society. Yeah, there's so much misunderstanding.
And because he has the same idea that a lot of the hearing public do, that you know, oh, poor deaf person can't talk.
They need to be fixed. They need a cochlear implant. From what I know from the outside of deaf community, is like a lot of them, like getting a cochlear implant is like seen as like is unnecessary, because it's deaf culture is valid in and of itself.
Yeah. Getting a cochlear implant is often seen as trying to become hearing, which ultimately, if you are deaf, will inevitably gravitate back towards the deaf community in adulthood, Because even a cochlear implant cannot make you fully hearing, and so it's damaging for the deaf community to have kids sort of forced out of it and tried to make them become hearing.
And there's a spectrum of hearing ability as well.
Yes.
I mean, so it's like...
And that's the other thing, one of the list of things not to do to your deaf character. Very few deaf people are profoundly deaf. And that's another of the things that Lucas discovers about Rochelle, is that, you know, she can hear doors slamming. And he sort of, you know, it surprises him, is she not totally deaf? You know, how deaf is she? Well, how long is a piece of string?
Yeah.
Or how short in the sky? Well,
how deep is the sky? I don't know.
There's also another minor thing relating to cochlear implants, which probably is one reason why they're so, which I've heard is one reason why they're rather unsuccessful, is that when you're a hearing person and you're growing up a hearing person, you your brain develops to handle the sound. That space in someone who's deaf is taken up with other things. The brain has adapted to do other things instead. A cochlear implant doesn't actually give them the facility that you or I might have.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of debate on cochlear implants, and it's definitely not my place to sort of make judgment calls on it, because I'm not deaf.
Right.
I'm in the outer circle of the deaf community.
None of us are deaf. We are only speaking from what we have learned from.
I've taken deaf studies at Victoria for 2 years now, and so I've learned a bit about it, but I mean, I'm not qualified to make those calls on it. But from what I've seen, the attitude of a lot of deaf people is that cochlear implants are a bit of an iffy thing, especially when they're given to children.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if as an adult you make that call that you want to have one because, you know, you might need a little bit of hearing or whatever, for whatever reasons, you know, that's sort of a different thing, but it's sort of, it can be a bit stigmatizing, I think. I just want to clarify that, as I said, I'm not an ambassador for the deaf community.
No, this is entirely just,
And
I'm of the opinion, since I'm a huge cyberpunk fan and stuff like that, I'm kind of like, well, why can't we all get cochlear implants just to have, like, you know, like bat-like hearing? I'm looking forward to that when we advance beyond, you know, the what's considered the average human, superhuman hearing. That's awesome.
I'm with that.
I'm for that.
My issue is with human hearing.
But with consent.
Yeah. Yes.
With informed consent.
I certainly sympathize. I have an issue that all our hearing is on a two-dimensional thing. We're able to tell if something's coming from our left or our right, but we're not necessarily very good at telling if a sound's coming from above or below.
Yes.
So part of me always wishes, well, shouldn't I have just a third sensor somewhere so I have an indication?
I want an ear on top of my head.
Yeah, pretty much. So, you know, it's a three-dimensional world. I want three-dimensional hearing.
Well, I read
360 degrees.
Yeah. I've read in one book about, like that had a deaf character, and like when they did have a hearing aid of some sort, but when it was removed, they spoke through bone conduction by placing their forehead against someone else's forehead, and you could speak, and you can actually, your skull conducts, you know, sound much like it, so you can
kind of.
I was like, that's interesting. I actually am like, hey, Aaron, come here. I'm going to put our skulls together and talk. And he's like, what are you doing?
Nothing. Yes.
Anyway.
Well, Rochelle in the book has just standard hearing aids, just the ones that just go behind your ear, so she doesn't have a cochlear implant. Which actually is very different. The cochlear implant doesn't even go through the ear at all.
Uh-huh.
It wires straight into the brain. So you're not even, it's not even,
obvious exterior hearing aid.
Oh, no, it is.
It's not. Oh, it is.
It's huge. There's a magnet on your head. It clips into your hair.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it doesn't use the ear at all. It goes into the brain.
Okay.
But Rochelle just has ordinary hearing aids. So it's, I don't go into cochlear implants in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is such a contentious thing.
Yeah.
So we should probably actually take that whole section out of the podcast.
We can bring it up. It's fine.
We
welcome any comments that if people, you know, constructive feedback is appreciated, I would say, if people want to add.
So I don't go into the whole implants versus hearing aid thing in the book, because the point is that Rochelle is very comfortable with who she is, and that throws Lucas when he first meets her. Because he doesn't understand that she can be so very comfortable in her own skin, even though she has what he considers a major disability. So yeah, so it's, yeah, he sort of, I mean, his sister, who is the, sort of fills the role of the wise one, even though she herself is not a perfect person, because no one is.
No.
She understands things about Rochelle that Lucas doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so Lucas sort of has those conversations with his sister about, you know, why he's so uncomfortable with Rochelle, and because he can't understand that she is so very happy in her own skin. So it's about Lucas learning to accept Rochelle, and learning to accept that she is fine the way she is, and that it's fine that she's fine the way she is.
Okay.
And yeah, and the other side is Charlotte learning to accept that she can be herself, yeah, and be loved for being herself rather than for latching on to guys and making them happy.
Sweet.
Yeah. Fantastic. So you mentioned that this was your NaNoWriMo story last year. What can we expect this year? Coming out? Are you working on anything in particular?
Actually, I am not doing NaNo this year, because I know it's shocking. For a number of reasons. I mean, I have intensive summer courses starting halfway through, so I just won't have time. But also, I am currently planning my next novel, and I won't be able to start doing the research for it until the end of November. And so I don't want to start writing it until then. But yes, I will be working on my next book very soon. Because the other night I was just lying on my bed staring at the ceiling, and I thought, I'm a published author.
Woo!
And I thought, I should do that again. So yes.
It's a good feeling. How about you, Ron?
Am I doing NaNo?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I am. I will be doing NaNo this year.
Fantastic. Do you have a particular plan in mind, or are you just going to wing it?
It's always a little bit of a combination with me. I'm not a heavy planner as other people. I usually just go for a feeling or an idea. Feelings and ideas, and I mean, I've given some thought to what the story is going to be about, and who's it about, and what the major themes are, and I'm just trying to sort of figure out a destination, and once I have that, I'll be set to go.
Great.
So it's all very vague. But
it's much the same for me. I mean, last year, because this is the second time I've finished NaNo, and the first time I was writing sort of a real life, kind of a novelization of my life that year, but this time with totally different, you know, and original characters and everything, I found that sort of the planning and everything it helped, but more from a character point of view. So I mean, I made notes about the characters and what I wanted them to achieve through the story, but really, I mean, yeah, I tend to wing it as well. When I go into NaNo, I write and I see where it takes me.
My previous NaNos I've done, I mean, I've generally worked off like an A4 page, and I'll have like perhaps a list of things I want to do, and then that I think are good sort of plot points, and then and sometimes it'll just twist in my hand, so to speak, and it'll take it to a different direction. But that's
sometimes it does.
But that's the best part of it, to be honest. That's the part where you surprise yourself, and I think that's the part that you enjoy the most, especially in retrospect.
Yeah, I think I still have the notebook from last year. In the last few days of October, I think I was waiting for a friend one day. I was just sitting on a bench, and I was thinking so much about these three, because at that point I already had Lucas, Charlotte, and Rochelle, and I was thinking so much about them. I just pulled out a notebook, and I made a heading on three pages, one for Lucas, one for Charlotte, one for Rochelle, and I just started writing, and I ended up going over writing on the other side of the page, because I just had so much in my head to put down onto paper, and I've still got those notebooks somewhere. I think that was even before Lucas had a surname.
Fantastic. How about you, Angela?
I've had ideas, but it's I don't think I'll be doing NaNo this year. I mean, I might decide that the ideas in my head are just too good. I do have to start like getting them out, because otherwise they just sort of get all cluttered. I had two ideas. One was actually technically not a novel, but in a relationship advice book, semi-serious, semi-conspiracy theory. and the other one was a
favorite kind.
Political, I know, right? It was like a political dystopic, you know, future US sort of thing, vaguely Hunger Games-ish, but possibly including supernatural elements. So, that one occurred to me only just last week, and it was really exciting. But then, as I thought, like, oh, Nano's like just a short time away, and I actually like to prepare a bit more. Like when I did it 2 years ago, I still have that manuscript which I should be editing, and 2 years ago I did spend the month of October just writing an outline and a timeline of events, stuff I wanted to happen, characters I definitely thought should be in it, and sort of elements I wanted to include. So preparation is very reassuring for me, so I would employ them. And speaking of which, we did have one member of our writer's group who has done extensive preparation, and she was going to be here today, but she had her appendix out just a week ago. Poor Sarah. She was on last podcast, the dear murder-obsessed girl.
She's my flatmate, actually, uh-huh. Sarah is, and also she edited a different three words. She's my friend, flatmate, and editor.
Yep. And she's been doing a lot of Nano preparation. Even she's a trooper. Even when she was in hospital, right when they were diagnosing her, she was there with her tablet and Karin saying, like, let's get off a few more writing exercises, you know. And
she's amazing.
So, like, on her blog, which is at writingkills.me, and she has a
writing kills me.
That's what I think it's meant to be. I never checked if there's writing kills.
She writes so much. I mean, yeah. There have been
writing,
times when
this is why she has appendicitis.
Yes.
Well, no. She's one of the people who has the distinction of a I think she, at one point she got a bit of RSI because she was typing so much.
She did.
I think,
I mean, that's the level of typing she does. It's quite scary sometimes.
Last year, she was very sad she couldn't do Nano last year because she had worked so hard to finish the manuscript she was working on at that point in time for Nano that she basically got RSI and couldn't do Nano because she just couldn't type anymore.
She writes to self-destruction.
Yes,
writing kills her.
Writing does kill her.
Right.
So I've just been handed some notes about her writing bootcamp, which she was working on for pre-NaNoWriMo. She came up with 30 writing exercises to complete throughout the month of October. Some days which would just be free writing to build speed and endurance. But of course, yes, an appendectomy is something that will put a crimp in your writing. Believe me, I've been there.
And what the point for today?
The point for today, oh yes, because it's day 25 today.
So close.
Is to make dialogue sound natural. She says, dialogue shouldn't be written like a real life conversation. But everything that comes out of your character's mouth should sound like something a real person would say. Therefore, it makes reading aloud is often quite helpful.
Yeah, like, what do you guys think of that?
Yes, I have actually found that, because I've found with writing I've done in the past that I read it afterwards and the dialogue is very stilted. So what I actually do sometimes is I sit and I listen to people talk, and I just sort of jot down what they're saying exactly as they say it. Or sometimes I might even just sort of record part of a conversation I'm having with a friend and then listen to it later and just sort of work out exactly what kinds of things people say. Like, people do start sentences twice, and they do sort of pause in the middle, and there are ums and there are ahs. I find observing people talking is the best way to write dialogue.
What I've heard a lot is that while it's useful to emulate dialogue, and when you're writing, and often you do, it's also useful to keep in mind this is a dramatization. You don't have to be completely faithful to it, and sometimes you can be more concise with your dialogue than most people usually are, and it will actually work. So you can actually have relatively well-spoken characters, more well-spoken than the average person is, and people will accept it quite happily. I don't mean well-spoken as they go in for paragraphs, but I mean well-spoken as in they are pithy, they are succinct and articulate, and slightly more pithy, succinct and articulate than most people.
Yes, I always find it's a good way is to try and balance between Hollywood movie dialogue and real life dialogue. You'd want to try and find the middle ground.
Yeah.
so that it's realistic without
being overly unbelievable, like with some
cliche.
Some directors films like we can point to, or directors and screenwriters like Joss Whedon, Kevin Smith, and Diablo Cody. I think you could pretty much watch any of their films and be like, yeah, you can tell when they've been working on the script because that they're all talking like, you know, my husband compares them to the Gilmore Girls. Like that for some reason was his first point of reference. Mm-hmm. Like they all just talk like they're all just incredibly pithy and witty, and like they all seem to be aware in on the joke.
Yeah. Kind of thing. I have that a little bit with Quentin Tarantino. I always feel like every character. My thing with Quentin Tarantino is I sometimes feel every character in Quentin Tarantino films has a bit of
Quentin in their head.
Exactly.
sorry about some Quentin.
So that's something you probably want to avoid. But there's some flexibility.
There are some. What helps for me often is watching movies or TV shows where the actors have taken the dialogue and really made it their own, and because that sort of written dialogue, scripted dialogue, that becomes real. So that is kind of walking that line between real life, which can be very sort of slow and boring and sort of impeding to watch, and the very sort of scripted Shakespeare, oh Titus, bring your friends hither. Mm-hmm. And I tell you who I love watching in that respect is Jensen Ackles.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen quite a few things he's done, and I mean, there's his face, which I just love because it's so expressive and everything, but even like what he does with dialogue, where you will see him start to say something and then change halfway. Uh-huh. And that's often sort of if I feel like my dialogue is just awful and stilted, I'll just watch something that he's in. 10-inch Hero is a good one.
That's a film he's in?
Yes. Yeah. And that's actually, that was actually filmed in 2007, and later that year he started dating his co-star in it, who is now his wife and mother of his child. So that's cute. But so I'll watch something that he's in and just sort of listen to the way he uses the dialogue that he's been given.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very refreshing to sort of see scripted lines made real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, it makes you realize, like, hey, this actor is not just a trained poodle just walking on hind legs and like, arf, arf, arf.
Another point that's just come into my head is that if you're looking to try and emulate dialogue, to go and watch improv shows.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because these are people who are improvising for an audience.
Mm.
But at the same time, they are making up every single thing they're saying on the spot.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's a number of improv communities here in Wellington, and I happen to be involved with pretty much all of them. but it is a widespread phenomenon, so you can certainly Google improv in your area and find someone who's doing it.
Mm. Mm.
Okay, so we're going to move on and discuss what we are reading right now. And I personally, I'm reading H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon, the best and weirdest of his collected works.
Is it edited by someone in particular, then? It's a recent...
It's a semi-recent publication. I can't tell you off the top of my head who it's published by, but it's the same group, I think, that have been doing several of the old school writers. Big black cover.
Okay.
Hardbound. Gold lettering.
That sounds fun, yeah.
Mm.
I haven't read much Lovecraft lately.
How about you, Ron?
I'm starting off with a book. I work at the Central Library, and a colleague gave me a book called Slouching Towards Bethlehem.
Hmm.
By Joan Didion. I'm not sure how much of it I'm going to get through, but it's well written, that's for sure.
What is it? Is
it it's a... Well, actually, it's a non-fiction, but it's by essays by Joan Didion. But some of this really does read like fiction, so I'm disillusionment with a sort of a little bit of middle class angst. in California around the 60s. So that's, I don't know, it wins me over mostly because of the writing is, I think, really quite good.
Mm.
I finished recently, I finished a recent novel in, someone Brett, The Daylight War, I forget the,
Daylight War.
It's from the Painted Man series, by, yeah. But it's, if people hear this and they look up, The Painted Man, they'll find it. It's a, it's an okay series. I just read it all the way through. It was quite compulsive reading. some things part of me goes, I would have done this differently, but, yeah, but it's quite compulsive reading, so I found it quite entertaining.
Great. Actually, you mentioned Starching Towards Bethlehem. I could have sworn that a couple of years ago someone put together a Fringe show using that as the basis.
Oh.
That sounds familiar, actually.
Probably. Mm.
Fringe, of course, being the...
The local New Zealand...
Annual culture...
Culture and Arts Festival.
Theatre
and music...
Outside the mainstream.
Yeah. Nothing is off the board.
Yeah.
Very similar to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, of course.
Yep. I was actually in a Fringe Festival show this year, which was a musical soap opera in 15 parts. So we had 15 different episodes.
Yeah, we came
to see
some of that. That was cool.
That's right, you did, yes. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing that Fringe is. It's weird shows and not so weird shows, but yeah.
It is a good chance for people to get outside their comfort zone in terms of writing or performing or as being an audience.
Yeah, yes. I mean, there's... I remember seeing one particular show which was, quite eye-opening in some cases. So it was a lot of good stuff there.
Mm. How about you, Caroline? What are you reading at the moment?
I have actually been reading The Boy Who Fell to Earth by Kathy Lett. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her surname properly. I think it's Lett.
How's it spelled?
L-E-T-T-E.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what seems natural to me, but it might be Letty or something, I don't know. Anyway, I've been reading The Boy Who Fell to Earth, which is about a single mother of a boy with Asperger's.
Okay.
And it's immensely funny. It's funny and it's touching, it's heartwarming, because she's trying to find a strong male figure for her son, and it's all about how, you know, her husband left him in the first place, and the men she's dated, and the one who looks like he's going to stick around, and then her husband turns up again. But it's hilarious, because of course Asperger's and everything on the spectrum of autism comes in so many different kinds. And I have some experience with Asperger's myself, because I have someone close to me has Asperger's, but this was just a totally different side. This was the sort of exuberantly affectionate side, and it was, I mean, it's, there's bits where I'm just reading it and I'm going, yep, I know that feeling, or, you know, this is so totally accurate. And I don't know if the author knows anyone with Asperger's, but if she doesn't, then she's quite clearly done her research very well.
One small point from someone who actually has Asperger's. It's pronounced with a hard G.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's Asperger's.
Asperger's.
Okay, because I've heard it both ways, and the person I know pronounces it Asperger's with a soft G.
Interesting.
I think it varies depending on...
It's a German...
So it would be Asperger's.
Yeah.
I'm currently reading... Well, about to read Mad Adam, which is Margaret Atwood's latest... I'm looking forward to it muchly because it's the third in the trilogy, from starting with Oryx and Crake and falling into Year of the Flood. It involves she's just so good at dystopia. Margaret Atwood just owns dystopic fiction, you know, starting with The Handmaid's Tale and going on down.
Classic, yeah.
And these are just, and this particular trilogy has elements of I'd say biopunk, because there's a lot of engineering, because basically engineering dooms the Earth. Like, it starts with all these, creating, hybrid animals, like pigoons and rekunks, and then it creates the Krakers, which are these sort of, somewhat perfected humanoid people, and then it goes all tits up. So to summarize it brilliantly, yeah. Sorry, I should be. I've been intending to reread the. I'm going to reread Oryx and Crake first, and then Year of the Flood, and then tackle Mad Adam, and it'll be bitchin'.
Awesome. So we've also been. Last week we commented on, well, month rather, we commented on book to film adaptations that we've been looking forward to. Now, personally, I live in a sort of black hole when it comes to book to film adaptations.
Really?
But how are you guys feeling about what's coming out
in
the near future?
What I'm really looking forward to is The Fault in Our Stars.
Oh, what's the, I haven't heard of that one. Oh, actually, the tale sounds familiar, but I don't know what it's about.
It's, The Fault in Our Stars is based... It's a movie adaptation of the John Green novel of the same title.
Okay.
And it's about two young people with cancer.
Oh.
So, you know, this girl who has always been terminal meets a guy who is, you know, recovered or, you know, recovering. And, yeah, it's about them and they're both very, very intelligent. I think she's 16, he's 17. And yeah, it's about how they sort of meet and become friends and fall in love and it's definitely the novel is one of my most favourite things. I mean, I love anything John Green writes,
mm-hmm.
and Tifios is no exception. And we've been seeing a lot from the set of the movie because John Green is on set with them, mm. And the lead cast is Shailene Woodley plays Hazel and Ansel Elgort plays Augustus, and they look exactly like I imagined them in my head.
I love when that happens.
Yes, it's brilliant, and we get all sorts of photos from the set because John is very excited about it, and so he's, you know, tweeting about it and posting photos on Tumblr, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. I'm slightly looking forward to the conversion of Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom.
Really?
The autobiography is coming out, and it's going to be starring Idris Elba.
Oh, great.
Who is liked in some quarters. I am certainly, my interest has piqued to a certain extent because he's playing it. Mm-hmm. Playing Nelson Mandela of all people, so it's quite a role.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's interesting. Hopefully I'll see that.
That's on par with Helen Mirren playing the Queen.
Yeah.
It's like this is the role that you have to do right.
Yeah. Nelson Mandela has a good reputation because he basically, I mean, my understanding is he basically stopped South Africans from killing each other after apartheid. That is, I think, to me, that's his major claim to fame. But before he was arrested, just before he was arrested, he'd actually given up on the peaceful movement more or less altogether. And he was arrested just as he was saying, okay, we've tried the peaceful thing, now we'll try violence because nothing else is working.
It
was then he was picked up by some police and said, "No, you look at this in your car. You're out. You're in jail." And so I think that part of Nelson Mandela might be emphasized because certainly something I can see Idris Elba doing very well. I mean, he's very good at playing warlike characters. I think so. That part of I suppose it's going to be more interesting to see how he does the more peaceful aspects of Nelson Mandela as well.
Yeah, the thing about biopic films is they do best when they portray the person as a person, you know, like they're people, whenever someone is usually big enough, well-known enough, famous enough to have a biopic about them, it's pretty much they're elevated to like God or demon status, basically, depending on what they did, depending on how, just if they overwhelmingly did good things or overwhelmingly did bad things, then that's pretty much the only way they're portrayed. But if this is a nuanced portrayal, then that's a good thing. That's what I feel like again Helen Mirren did for the Queen. So, and I think Idris Elba is definitely an actor that could portray like all potential sides of Nelson Mandela.
Because that's the line you have to tread very carefully when you're portraying a real person, especially one who is still alive.
Yep.
Is, because no person is perfect. Everyone has their good parts and their bad parts. Mm. And you have to be very careful when you're playing that, that, you know, you don't make them out. It's almost more dangerous to make them out to be this perfect person than it is to demonize someone.
Well, actually, with Nelson Mandela, his image, his reputation is so very good.
Yes.
That if you, it'll be, they're going to have to be very careful if they do criticize Nelson Mandela or have some less than perfect things, especially since they're going off his own work, which, I mean, he doesn't make himself. To Nelson Mandela's credit, he doesn't make himself out to be a hero of his own story very much. In some respects, I suppose that's one reason why everyone likes him, because that's his writing is has or at least my impression when I read it, his writing has a degree of humility to it that you don't necessarily always see. But honestly, criticizing Nelson Mandela would be hard. Very hard. Politically, never mind in terms of entertainment, but politically be very, very hard to do.
Yeah.
He is possibly the most revered person in international politics.
Currently alive, yes, I would say.
Yeah.
Movie adaptations. Yeah, there were a few we mentioned last month that we were looking forward to, but frankly, I can't let it pass without comment. The fact that Ender's Game is being made into a movie... Oh, let me count the ways. Okay, something that I know people in New Zealand are definitely mad about is that Sir Ben Kingsley, who's a fine actor, is being cast to play Maser Rackham, who is a man of Maori descent.
Ooh.
With and he appears on screen wearing full moko. I don't know what iwi or how he's supposed to be in. Being that we're all Pākehā here, I think even of descent, like I don't think we can't quite comment on that directly, but we can definitely say that over there. That tends to be what's going on over there.
You might want to check that.
What's wrong with the lovely, you know, Maori actors that we have in New Zealand?
This is very fun. Yes, that I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, like, well, yes, honestly, why isn't Cliff Curtis or Tamara Morrison available? Especially considering that anytime they're cast in something in Hollywood, they're playing... Okay, Tamara Morrison, last time he was in Hollywood, played an alien, I think, Abin Sur in Green Lantern. And that actually had another Maori actor in it, Taika Waititi, playing a gentleman of Inuit descent. It's like two Maori actors in one film, and they're neither a Maori. And Cliff Curtis, pretty much every time he's on screen, is like playing a Latino or... Yeah.
Who was it who was in Sunshine?
I don't remember who was in Sunshine. Was it Cliff Curtis?
I think it might have been Cliff Curtis.
Yes. It's amazing
But I was watching that and I was thinking, I recognize you, and I'm pretty sure you're Maori, but you're not... You're just sort of being cast as person of
as a random brown person. He played a caveman in 30,000 BC.
I mean,
So here we were with a great opportunity to play and have an actual Maori playing a Maori, like, which never happens outside of New Zealand.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Got, you know, whale rider, once warriors, Maori playing Maori, brilliant. And then you get all the, you know, outside New Zealand Maori actors cast as indeterminate
as Latin drug lord, Arab terrorist,
caveman, or
alien.
Yes,
wearing lots of prosthetic.
And then when there is in a major film a role going that the character himself is Maori, and you get
Sir Ben Kingsley,
a Brit, to play him.
An Anglo-Indian gentleman, who is wonderful again.
We need to at least defend Ben Kingsley. He's a good actor.
I'm sure he will play the role very well.
I don't think he'll be randomly doing inaccurate haka.
It makes me sad that there was this wonderful opportunity and they.
Does Orson Scott Card have much familiarity with a
I doubt it.
With Maori culture?
I don't know. I did never finish reading Ender's Game, so maybe I shouldn't read about it.
I never read Ender's Game, so I'm a little divorced from the...
So yeah, what Maser Rackham, the character, can you describe
it? I haven't read it for years, but pretty much there was one point I believe the only, or certainly in Ender's Game, I don't know if he's mentioned or how much in depth he's gone into in the sequels, because I can't remember if I've read those or not. But in Ender's Game itself, you know, he's described as, you know, this hero, and he's a hero, you know, he's a hero, Maze Rackham is a hero. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one sentence, you know, if Maze Rackham, a half Maori boy from New Zealand, can do this, then Ender can blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Well, just a throwaway line, sort of.
Kind of. Which, I mean, is on the one hand good, because it's not making a huge deal out of, oh, your race is all you are.
I guess, but...
I mean, I kind of like that, and it made me happy. It was kind of like, oh, this person that we've known to be a hero for this whole book, he's from my country.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I sometimes feel... I don't know. I'm sometimes a little uncomfortable with... Occasionally a little uncomfortable with the borrowing of... of a exotic culture,
yeah.
Or a or I don't know, race. I don't like to use the term race, because it's actually a little bit it's a fuzzy concept at best.
But cultural appropriation is a thing. Yeah, that's happened
and that's one of the things I worry times. That this might be a little bit of a case of, in the writing sense.
Given other things we happen to know about Orson Scott Card,
and then the other beyond the problematic casting, Orson Scott Card is a homophobic bigot.
Yeah. Is he still alive?
Oh,
he's
still alive,
and he won't stop.
My understanding is actually he's being kept out of the press right now.
Yes, but yeah, to try to downplay
by the developers of the film.
When he's never, he's never apologized. He has never recanted for his views, and he does not deserve my money, or I think the money of any right-thinking person. So I fully advocate the boycotting of Ender's Game.
And that is because you don't agree with the story itself, or because
I disagree with the author has gone beyond
the thing for me I first read Ender's Game when I was in year 10, and I read it again a couple of years ago, and I think it's a lovely story. I like Ender's Game as a story, and it saddens me that the author is so bigoted.
Mm-hmm.
Do his values come through in the book, in your opinion?
I have heard analyses and critiques of Ender's Game that say, oh, this is an example of Orson Scott Card believing this, and I'm sort of like, okay.
Because sometimes,
that's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
When I read it, it didn't jump out at me as, oh, yo, this is this bigotry coming through. So I think the story itself is a good story. It's a heartwarming story. It's very harrowing in some parts. People die.
Yeah. Well, no, I suppose I'm asking because sometimes, I mean, there's the question of whether the values jump out at you. But that's often... if they jump out at you, often it means that you're probably not going to be affected by them. It's if you don't recognize the values being propounded, but often subconsciously absorb them anyway. That's what gets people worried, really. Not the whether you can identify the values or not.
What needs to be understood about his particular form of bigotry is, judging from interviews with him, he conflates almost in part or in full the practice of pedophilia with homosexuality.
Ooh.
So that's on which whenever you see his work verging on, this was pretty large in Hamlet's Father or whatever, like this he did a sequel to Hamlet or a rewriting of Hamlet, and it was all like that sort of thing, like, and so about how like Hamlet's father deserved to die because he was a horrible gay pedophilic bastard. That is basically, that is Orson Scott Card's opinion just writ large, because he clearly felt entitled to do that. So yeah, again, if you I think personally that if you do not believe that, you know, if you do not agree with him that homosexuality is equivalent to pedophilia, you should not support his work. I mean, other people are free to disagree, but I've seen a lot of people trying to, like, get around, like, the notion that's like, well, go see the movie, but then go see another movie or donate the same amount. And I'm just like, I just say, just don't see the movie if you really find his views distasteful. That's where my ethics line up, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I probably, because, I do like the book. I probably will see the movie, because I want to see what they do with it.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't. I mean, I haven't done my research thoroughly enough to be able to properly comment on Orson Scott Card. Mm-hmm. All I know is what other people have said.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me sad that, you know, a person who has written something which is so
significant. It's so definitely significant.
It's definitely significant, and it is a good book.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like, you know, I think I've read one of the sequels, because it's a quartet, and I've read the first two, and I think I started on the third. And I do love the way he writes and the stories he tells. And it makes me sad that the person who has written that is actually himself.
Has said some horrible things.
Has said some horrible things.
You don't always, you know, you can still enjoy the book a little bit.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That I separate Ender's Game from Orson Scott Card because the book, as a work of fiction, is good. Yeah. And I like it.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I'll see the movie, because the movie is not an adaptation of Orson Scott Card. It's an adaptation of Ender's Game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
That's fair enough.
And in many ways, in order to have an opinion on something, you have to have first seen it.
Very true. Very true.
I possibly won't actually go and see it in the cinema. But I'll probably see it. I'll probably watch it at some point.
But, you know, I'll be interested to know if it's good. Even though I probably won't see it. I probably won't see it. I might eventually, if it's really good, I might see it myself in, like, the video. But I'm not, I'm not definitely not part of the vanguard.
No, me neither. And I mean, I've got friends who are really, really excited for it, and I can understand why, because they very much grew up with Ender's Game and loved it. It was a book of their childhood, whereas I came to it sort of later in life.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's less like, oh my god, they're finally making a movie of Ender's Game. It's like, oh, okay, I think I've read that. Oh yeah, I remember that. That's exciting, I guess.
Yeah.
It's been on reading lists, but when I worked at Borders, I did notice it was on, like, summer reading lists, along with Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, a lot of stuff. It was heartwarming to see genre fiction being put on reading lists. And for what it's worth, it's one of those things where, like, I think I've heard people argue that, like, it could get very tedious to boycott people because there are people out there who probably espouse, like, and have done horrendous things that you don't know about that you're giving money to. But I don't know. I think when someone's just made such a great big public ass of themselves, like Orson Scott Card, about this sort of thing, you kind of can't ignore it. So, I mean, I think it is up to people to up to people to make their own decisions. But
And I mean,
there certainly will be a public cost. To,
oh yes,
yes,
there will be.
And I guess when it comes to Orson Scott Card, his views do offend me personally because I am gay, and so it's a bit difficult for me to sort of look at him and look at his work. I think it's because I knew his work and loved his work before I knew about his own opinions that I am able to do that. Certainly if I'd known about him and everything he sort of
had stood for, it would have coloured your opinion.
I probably would never have read his work.
It's disappointing. It's kind of like, tangentially reminds me of when Stephen Fry was discussing his love of Wagner and stuff like that, but Wagner's, you know, kind of association with Third Reich, and Stephen Fry's like, you know, I'm a gay person of Jewish descent, you know,
I certainly I felt a little less close to Stephen Fry when I heard him saying how much he loved Wagner. I'm one of the people who did effectively get, I mean, my mum's side of the family did effectively were expelled from Europe.
They were
Jewish Germans and Dutch Jews, and they were, you know, survived by the skin of their teeth.
So Ender's Game, see it if you want, don't see it if you don't want. It's, you know, there's reasons for and against.
It's up to everyone. Should vote with their money and their conscience. I say what your conscience
and
tells you to.
If your reason for not going to see it is that you don't agree with Orson Scott Card's views, that's a perfectly valid reason. If your reason for going to see it is that the book was an amazing part of your childhood, that's a perfectly valid reason to go see it.
And if it's anything like The Hobbit is to Tolkien's book, then it won't be anything like them.
Well, hopefully it's not going to be three films.
The Hobbit.
I am looking forward to The Desolation of Smog.
I just want to see Brian Blessed.
I want to see Brian
Blessed because he's playing one of the Dwarven Lords.
He is? I think
he's actually only in the last one, so he probably won't be in this one. But we still get Benedict Cumberbatch
And Stephen Fry.
Stephen Fry
plays the Master of Lake Town.
I am very much looking forward to that. Yes, I saw the first one in the cinema twice. I think I enjoyed it more the first time, but it was definitely worth a rewatch. So I think I will definitely go and see The Desolation of Smaug in the cinema.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. So that's
great. So that has been the Ink to Slingers podcast.
Yes.
For October. Join us next month. We will be talking about NaNoWriMo, NaNoWriMo, and more NaNoWriMo. Stay tuned.
You've been listening to Wellington Inkslingers. Our theme music is Metricity by Declan Doherty Ramsey. You can find us on Twitter at inkslingerswgtn and on Tumblr at Wellington Writers. Thanks for listening.